From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up the conversation from our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with Pastor Rankin Wilburn, author of The Cross Before Me, Reimagining the Way to the Good Life. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Pastor Wilburn in their conversation.
You write over and over again in the book about happiness. That again becomes a mega theme within the context of the book. And I love the story you tell about Andre Agassi and Tom Brady and Brad Pitt. They're all looking for happiness. And Brad Pitt, for example, says he's sitting on prosperity, sitting on wealth, he's sitting on fame and fortune, and yet he can't answer the question, how do you find happiness? Tom Brady, 6 Super Bowl rings and counting, and he's still searching for that which would make one truly happy. Agassi says the same thing in his book. Here's the quintessential tennis star. What and where can I find happiness? What is it? Where can I find it? And you don't write about them in a depreciating way, but you use them as the illustration of people that have reached the pinnacle of success, but still don't know where to find this elusive thing that we call happiness.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pastor in Los Angeles, so I try and start where the people in Los Angeles are, and that was the first sentence of Aristotle's Ethics 2,400 years ago. The first sentence was, all men seek happiness. And Aristotle took that as a given, that everyone, whatever they do, they're motivated to seek happiness. And of course, many philosophers and writers have said that. And so we started the book with Agassi and Tom Brady and Brad Pitt to sort of say to our hyper-ambitious L.A. crowd, at least where I'm pastoring, to say, you're climbing this mountain that you think when you get to the top is going to fill your heart. And now here are some people who have climbed. They have climbed the mountain of their respective professions. I mean, they are the best in the world. And they are all telling you with one voice, man, I got to the top of that mountain, and it didn't do for my heart what I was hoping and expecting it would. And we open the book that way to say maybe the way toward the flourishing you seek is not what you think. And maybe more to the point, maybe you don't know the way. And of course, Jesus says that. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, which is not just a statement about what happens when we die and the uniqueness of Christ in our salvation. It's also a statement about, as you said earlier, Hank, the abundant life Jesus intends for us. I am the way. And I'm telling you the truth about how to live. So in some ways, this book is a love letter to the church of about the decline of discipleship and the weakness of the Western church, the American church in particular. And might it be attributable that we're not listening to what Jesus is so clearly telling us about the way to pursue the life he has for us?
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, it's so interesting that you bring this up in context of the church, because I find it refreshing that you have Agassi and Brady and Pitt saying they don't know where to find happiness. They're candid. They've reached the pinnacle and they found that there's nothing there because they've been looking for happiness in all the wrong places. But in the church itself, we have so many megastars that are telling us that we can find happiness if we can harness the force of faith. That faith is a force, words are the containers of the force. if we harness this force, then we can have true happiness. We can have material success. We can have physical success. We can be healthy and wealthy. But it's all dependent on mustering up this tangible force called faith. So in the church, you have the insidious definition of happiness coming through a cultural, at best, kind of a formula, not a Christ kind of a formula, not a Christ kind of a teaching where Christ tells us that happiness is to delight in our Maker, to see the face of God, to give Him glory, the glory that He alone deserves, if we want to paraphrase what Isaiah says in Isaiah 42.
Right. Yeah, we've just adopted the world's definition of what makes for a good life, and we've used God and or Christ to give us that. And that's the heart of idolatry. You know, the heart of idolatry is, I don't really love God. I just want to use God to give me what I really love. And Martin Luther had a term for that. He said there are two types of theologians. And for Luther, we were all theologians because we all have ideas about ultimate concerns. But Luther said, you're either a theologian of glory or you're a theologian of the cross. And theologians of glory, Hank, you've described them well, are people who equate God's nearness and communion with God. They equate that with health and wealth and prosperity and blessing and size and importance. And Luther calls that theologians of glory. And which for Luther was the most pejorative term he could think of. And he contrasted that with a theologian of the cross. And he said a theologian of the cross is someone who knows God can only be had and known through the cross, through suffering, through the way of humility, through the way of sacrifice. And yeah, you don't hear that message as much because on the surface it's... Well, as Peter said to Jesus, this is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? It's so counter to the voices we hear, really, from anyone. I mean, we just don't hear the message today that happiness is communion with God, and the way to that communion is the way of the cross. I mean, where is that message? We hope it's in our book, and we hope we're picking up on, again, ancient biblical theology, but it's just not a message we hear a lot today.
It's interesting that you bring up suffering as part and parcel of the theology of the cross. And I can tell you from personal experience that suffering with stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma, and there was a lot of suffering involved in it. I went through a lot of chemotherapy and radiation and all kinds of prodding and prying of my body, the toll that that takes on you is quite significant. But that suffering, actually, when I describe it to people, is great. Because when you're not suffering, when you have health and wealth, when you have success, even prosperity within the context of Christian ministry, when everything you touch turns to gold, so to speak, you write bestsellers and you're popular and all of this, you don't really stop and recognize where true happiness lies. And you realize that it is empty, even if it's experienced within a Christian context. But when you suffer, then all of a sudden you come to a true valuation of things, and then you're poured out in new and better fashion. And so suffering, when people ask me about it, I tell them, you know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I am so glad that I not only was diagnosed with cancer, but that the cancer came back. I was in remission, and I kind of forgot. And then the cancer would come back, and I'd go back into remission, and again, I'd forget. And then the last time when the cancer came back, I realized just how significant suffering is. I realized that God isn't interested in healing me physically. He's interested in healing the whole of me. He's interested in doing spiritual surgery on me. And the only way he can do that sometimes is to get your attention through suffering. So suffering can be an incredible tributary into what you call reimagining the way to the good life.
Well, and that's how all the New Testament writers talk about it. I mean, think of so many scripture verses come to mind, but Romans 8 comes to mind. We are his children, co-heirs with Christ, provided that we suffer with him. Hebrews 5:8, that even Jesus learned obedience through what he suffered. That's just an amazing verse that if it weren't in the Bible, no one would have the audacity to say that Jesus needed to learn anything. And yet Hebrews says that there was something that Jesus could only learn through suffering.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Pastor Rankin Wilburn in just a few moments. The cross upsets our ideas of happiness. The Lord Jesus ascribed bliss to the meek and the merciful, the persecuted and the poor in spirit. The Beatitudes are not just clever turns of phrase meant to challenge our thinking, but are sticks of dynamite to blow up our conceptions of what makes a happy life. The way of the cross is counterintuitive to a culture seeking self-gratification. So Rankin Wilburn and Brian Greger wrote The Cross Before Me to define the good life and teach us to delight in losing ourselves to the life-giving weakness of the cross. Receive your copy of The Cross Before Me, Reimagining the Way to the Good Life by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
In the new book, The Cross Before Me, Pastor Rankin Wilburn and philosopher Brian Greger offer a provocative perspective on why the cross is not just the way to salvation, but the way to the abundant life. Drawing on biblical truth and historical writings, they ask, why do we still feel restless when things seem to be going our way? How can suffering bring more peace than success brings? And what does Jesus' cross teach us about how to live a full and flourishing life? This unique book helps us reimagine the good life as we learn to delight in surrendering our own power and embracing the life-giving weakness of the cross. Be sure to read The Cross Before Me. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and support the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Welcome back to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Let's rejoin Hank and Pastor Wilborn in their conversation.
James 1, count it all joy when you suffer trials of various kinds, that you may be mature and complete, James goes on to say, lacking in nothing. Isn't that interesting, that phrase, lacking in nothing? Like, I had to take something away from you that you thought you needed to give you what you really needed. That you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. So when James says to rejoice in suffering, he's not a masochist. It's that idea that oftentimes our idols have to be taken away from, the pried away from the grips of our fingers for God to give us, well, for God to give us the living water that we're really thirsting after, we're really longing for. And that's one of the great uses of adversity, is it tears our idols that were never going to give us that joy we wanted. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. And those idols have to be torn from our hands for God to give us something better.
Yeah, torn from our hands. That's absolutely right. And sometimes we're hanging on to them, and they literally have to be wrenched out of our hands. We have such an iron grip on what we think will make us happy, and we need to come to a true valuation of things. You mentioned your co-author, Brian, that one of his characteristics is humility. And this is something I pray for every day. One of the things that I offer to our constituency, I was so afraid, Rankin, that it would seem cheesy, but there was a cross that I had, a wooden cross, and on that cross is a prayer by Ephraim the Syrian. And it's a very short prayer. It goes like this: O Lord and Master of my life, give me not a spirit of sloth, idle curiosity, love of power, useless chatter, but rather, according to me, your servant, a spirit of chastity, humility, patience, and love. Yes, O Lord and King, grant that I may see my own faults and not condemn my brother, for you are blessed forever and ever. I pray that prayer every single morning. I have the cross up against my mirror, so when I walk into the bathroom in the morning and brush my teeth, it's the first thing I see, and I pray that prayer. And that prayer, I was sort of envisioning in my mind, I could see thousands of people doing that. And so I said, I'm going to offer that to people. And again, I don't know if people thought that was cheesy or didn't. I really don't know what the outcome of that is at this point. But I felt led to do that, and so I did. It was not to give someone a trinket, but to give someone a prayer that they could eventually have upon the canvas of their consciousness and constantly pray. So now I not only pray it in the morning, oftentimes when I'm praying in the afternoon or praying before I might take a nap or praying in the evening, that becomes a part of my prayer life as well. And I want to focus on that for a moment, because your book most certainly focuses on this subject of humility, the fact that Jesus said, learn from me because I'm humble, and you will find, when you find humility, you'll find rest for your own soul. So this way of humility, what is it? What does it mean to be truly humble?
Well, we use an old definition from one of my favorite writers, Bernard of Clairvaux, who wrote a treatise on humility 1,000 years ago. And Bernard is one of the great writers of church history. He's one of the few people that most all the camps seem to like. I mean, he's a doctor in the Catholic Church. He's behind Augustine, the most quoted writer in Calvin's Institutes. But Bernard wrote a little treatise on humility, and I like his definition of humility. He says humility is a due recognition of oneself before God, namely that we are unworthy persons. And so for Bernard, you know, he's writing 1,000 years ago, and it wasn't, you know, casting your head down and thinking, oh, I'm a terrible person. For Bernard, it was a cheerful acknowledgement of who we are before God, before a holy God. And, you know, 1,000 years later, C.S. Lewis made a definition of humility somewhat famous when he said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. And Bernard, it's interesting, if you read that old treatise from Bernard, he agrees that self-forgetfulness is the epitome of humility, but Bernard says, as far as he's concerned, that's so rare that he'd like to start on a more accessible rung. And it's just a sense of who we are before God. And of course, humility from the word humus, of the earth, that we are creatures. We are frail, finite creatures who live before a holy, omnipotent God who is our Father. And so humility, we say in the book, is the heart of the cruciform life. And the line you quoted is, it was Bernard who said how amazing it is that Jesus could have selected any virtue for us to learn from him. Bernard said, for he possessed them all in perfect measure. But when he could have selected anyone, he selected only one. He said, learn from me, for I am humble. And that this is above all what Jesus wants those who love him and who follow him to learn from him. Learn from me, for I am humble, and you will find rest. And so just that idea, I think you said it very well, Hank, of, Lord, my life is completely yielded to you, completely surrendered to your glory, to your name, not to my name, but to your name. That's the great picture of that in the Gospels is John the Baptist saying, you know, his sandals, the straps of which I'm not worthy to untie. That foot washing in that culture, as you know, was the lowest, the most menial task was foot washing. A Jewish slave wouldn't wash feet, only a Gentile slave would. So when John the Baptist says of Jesus, not only am I not worthy to wash his feet, I'm not even worthy to touch his sandals. He's just saying, compared to Jesus, I am so unworthy, and yet I am his and he is mine. So I'm dancing around it because it's better seen than defined, but I like the phrase, seeking the low place. You know, Jesus tells the parable in Luke 14 of when you're invited to a banquet, don't sit in the places of honor. Seek the low place. And that's a great parable on humility.
And so often we think that we have attained in that area, and then all of a sudden we catch ourselves in our own thought life and recognize that, yeah, that wasn't true humility. That still is about self-aggrandizement, even though it's way under the covers.
Yeah, well, I can't remember who said it, but someone said very wisely, you know you have a servant's heart by how you respond to when you're treated like a servant. And I always thought that was just such a wonderful test of, well, how we feel and how we react when we are slighted or mistreated is a really good test of how genuine our posture is.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's sort of a corollary to what you're saying that I've experienced. I remember at one time, you know, I have my share of critics, particularly because I've taken on some very controversial issues, not the least of which was the prosperity gospel in my first book, Christianity in Crisis. So as a result of that, you end up having a lot of garbage that's on the web, and then you want to protect your reputation, and then you want to go get a company that protects your reputation. And at the end of the day, particularly at this stage in my life, I'm thinking, no, I don't really want to clean up my own reputation, because my reputation, or at least the reputation that matters, is what does God think of me? What do those who are closest to me think about me? Do they see me as a hypocrite that is one thing on the radio and one thing in writing and another thing in real life, or do they see me as a genuine person? That's far more crucial than a company that can make you look good on the web.
Yeah. You find out if Jesus truly is your reputation when, what does Jesus say in the Gospel of John? He says, how can you believe when you love the praise that comes from man rather than the praise that comes from God? Like, how could you believe the gospel when your heart is still tied to the opinions and judgments of men? How could you believe that Jesus is your righteousness, that Jesus is your sufficiency, that Jesus is your reputation? And that's such a challenging line to me from the Gospel of John, and such an encouragement of, Lord, help me have a very low opinion of other people's opinion of me.
Yeah.
Help me have a very low opinion of my opinion of me. Lord, all that matters is, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, all that matters, Lord, is what you make of me.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We'll pick up Hank's conversation with Pastor Rankin Wilburn next time. As thanks for your gift in support of the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute, Hank Hanegraaff would like to send you the book, The Cross Before Me, by Pastor Rankin Wilburn and Brian Greger. Just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271, or just visit online at equip.org. That's equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
In the new book, The Cross Before Me, Pastor Rankin Wilburn and philosopher Brian Greger offer a provocative perspective on why the cross is not just the way to salvation, but the way to the abundant life. Drawing on biblical truth and historical writings, they ask, why do we still feel restless when things seem to be going our way? How can suffering bring more peace than success brings? And what does Jesus' cross teach us about how to live a full and flourishing life? This unique book helps us reimagine the good life as we learn to delight in surrendering our own power and embracing the life-giving weakness of the cross. Be sure to read The Cross Before Me. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and support the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org.